Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this fireside chat with Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Our moderator today is Nitin Nainani. Nitin is a judicial law clerk at the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Nitin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Caroline. And to everyone joining us this afternoon, welcome. I'm excited to host today's fireside chat with Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson. This is a timely conversation, given the recent developments in Europe and with the NATO summit coming up in late June. And to the extent possible, we'd love to include you, the audience members, in this discussion. So if you have a question, like Caroline said, please leave it in the Q&A box. If your question lines up with the ones that I'm asking, I'll try to incorporate it as we go through our structured questions portion. But if not, I'll try and make a point to get to it later during the program. Now, without further ado, I'm honored to introduce today's guest, Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Ambassador Hutchinson is a public servant and businesswoman. First elected to the Texas House of Representatives in 1972, Ambassador Hutchinson then served Texans as their state treasurer and then as a U.S. Senator for 20 years. Most recently, Ambassador Hutchinson served as a U.S. Ambassador to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization for 3 years in Brussels, where she managed the 250-people mission. Ambassador Hutchinson serves on the Dallas Mayor's International Advisory Council, UT Southwestern Medical Foundation Board of Trustees, the Bank of America Global Advisory Board, and the Board of Directors of the Atlantic Council. She is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the NASA Advisory Council. Ambassador Hutchinson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Nitin. It's very good to be with you, and I appreciate the time to talk about NATO.
Absolutely. So I want to get started today by drawing a little bit on your time in the United States Senate. In remarks that you had delivered back in February 2024, I thought it was interesting because you had mentioned that you had not given much thought to the idea of being an ambassador while you were a senator. But how did your time in the Senate, and especially on the different committees that you served on, prepare you and shape your approach to serving as the U.S. ambassador to NATO? And I ask this kind of both with, you know, your perceptions of, you know, the issues and the stakes involved, of course, but also how you transitioned from serving in the world's greatest, you know, deliberative body to now interacting with representatives from, you know, all sorts of alliance members.
Well, first of all, I never thought of being an ambassador at all. And when I was called right at the beginning of the administration, I was called by the State Department, really, Rex Tillerson's office, and they said, "How would you like to be an ambassador?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't think so." I had a son in high school, and I didn't know that that would be something good. But it turns out that I mentioned it to him after I had said no, and he thought it was just a great idea to go somewhere else for high school. And so I started thinking about it and what I could undo of my career. At that time, I'd been out of the Senate for about 3 years, and I liked what I was doing, but I decided to say yes if it was a place I wanted to go. And NATO was on my very short list. And I was so amazed at what a wonderful experience it was. And I had served on the Armed Services Committee. I'd served on the Defense Appropriations Committee. I was chairman of the Military Construction Subcommittee of Appropriations, and I was chairman of the Board of Visitors of West Point. So I was very steeped in our military, our security. Texas is a very pro-military state. So I traveled to NATO before when I was in the Senate, and was able to see how important it was to have the alliance and to have the countries that were working together doing more as a unit than would be able to be done separately. So I did have a good feeling about the importance of NATO, and I knew quite a bit about the things that were happening there. I'd also been on the field in the Balkans during the crisis with Bosnia. The Senate took a trip there, not the whole Senate, but several senators, Ted Stevens, Danny Inouye, myself, and others traveled to Bosnia when it was still at war. And so I was familiar with some of the problems that we are still facing today with that Eastern European area. And most certainly, it's important, I think, that we continue to have the support of the total alliance, because we are stronger in numbers.
So I guess during your time as, you know, as ambassador, certainly this is not, you know, too long after the issues in Crimea, but what would you say were your major focuses or priorities for the United States at NATO at that given point?
Well, the things that were happening when I was there as ambassador were, first of all, we were, like every president that I ever served with, starting with President Clinton and even before that, President H.W. Bush, concerned that Europe was not doing enough in its own defense, and we were working with Europe to really increase the amount of defense spending. So that was a major issue. And the U.S. had determined, after years of trying to work with Russia on its violations of the INF Treaty, that we had to withdraw from the treaty because we didn't have the defenses for a missile that was intermediate range that could reach Europe by Russia. And we had agreed not to have a defense against that missile. They had agreed not to make one, but they were violating. And so we had to work with the Europeans to make sure they understood why we were going to withdraw from the INF Treaty. And that was a big lift, because for them, the INF Treaty was a sense of security. But when Russia was violating it, we told them that we had to then immediately go to work for a defense against it, because we knew that Russia had a number of these violating missiles. So that was a big thing that we did during my time. And there, it was a negotiation, because the Europeans were very concerned about that. But eventually they all came on board and supported our position. In addition, it was in 2019 that the U.S. in their really 10-year strategic review determined that our strategic potential adversary that we must begin to deter was China. And that, again, was something that surprised everyone, especially the Europeans, because all of the countries involved, including us, were doing trade with China. The Europeans were concerned that maybe we were being over anxious about what China was doing, but we walked them through each piece of evidence that showed that China was building its defenses and that they were violating the World Trade Organization requirements and free trade, fair trade, but they were also being aggressive against countries in Europe, trying to establish a Belt and Road avenue for their ships, gaining infrastructure in the ports of Europe, as well as Australia, and then South American countries. So we showed the evidence, and while I was there, we were able to have in our summit an adoption of deterrence efforts looking to the future with China. Of course, at NATO, what you want to do is deter rather than have a conflict. And so the beginning of deterrence came in one of the NATO summits when I was there. But again, that was a big negotiation. And then we also, while I was there, opened the High North as an area of operation. And that too was not controversial, but it was something that was new, and all the allies needed to sign on, because that made the High North an area where we were going to expend more resources. And that was because the ice was melting in the High North Atlantic area, and Russian submarines were being detected in those waters. And so we began that. So those were the areas that we faced, that we negotiated and worked on when I was in the NATO from 2017 to 21.
And I guess what sort of role did the NATO partnerships play during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, in the 2021 timeframe, of course, everyone knew that COVID was spreading, but no one had a vaccine. In the time that I was at NATO, we never didn't go to work. We never closed the headquarters. We kept on doing all of the things that were necessary to do the business of NATO. And we had no vaccines, but we carefully distanced our chairs. We went to a different meeting place where we could be more distant. No one quite knew how to treat the safety measures, because we weren't totally sure what was how you were passing COVID along in the early stages. So we kept working. We kept the building open. The only precaution that we took, other than separating ourselves more and having smaller group meetings when needed, is that we had a big thermometer that you had to walk through when you came into the building. And if you had a fever, you were not allowed in the building. And so we had very few outbreaks. And I know that that with no vaccine at all, it was relatively safe. But Europe, Brussels shut down. And there was not a restaurant open. There was not a shopping mall open. The only thing open were the grocery stores in very short hours and pharmacies. Other than that, everything was closed. And the police even enforced that outside people could not enter a home that they did not live in. And so they were very careful. And NATO was very generous with helping to transport things like face masks and the things that you would put on your hands that would be antibacterial. We were very helpful. All of our countries were helpful in transporting these things to other places where there were outbreaks of of COVID. So I would say that NATO played a role, humanitarian as much as anything, because we all were sort of flying blind, but NATO and our NATO countries did quite a bit to help the people protect themselves as much as we could.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, on the note of challenges, did you face any challenges in your position, given the president's skepticism of NATO as a whole, or, you know, criticisms of even individual members of the alliance, as well as, you know, his, you know, aspirations for changing the relationship with Russia?
You know, I want to say that I have never been around such professional, great people as the ambassadors at NATO. We were 30 at the time, now 32, of course, and that's great. But we were so, people were very never personal about what the president might have been saying or anything that stopped a negotiation or talking about something that we had to solve. And the Europeans in general want America to be the leader of NATO. They know that we have the intelligence gathering capabilities that we share. They know that we are the country that will assess a risk and then begin to deter against it. And they look to us for leadership. So it was a great experience. And I have friends that I still talk to and communicate with. And they are, I can't say enough good about that diplomatic professionalism, because it was never thrown up to me that they were upset about something that might have been said or anything like that. They were there to get a job done, and we were all friends. We could all speak frankly about what we were trying to do, how we needed help, how we could work together. And it was just a really wonderful way of doing things that was different from the Senate. You know, just to make an aside, we made a joke almost, I did, of the Diplo speak, because I was in Senate speak mode, and Senate speak is direct, and you know, it can be something that doesn't mince words. It goes directly to the point. But diplomats, you know, they put a lot of adjectives in front of every word. And sometimes I would say, you know, that's diplo speak, but could we get into Senate speak for a minute here? And they would laugh and say, oh yeah, I forgot that you were in a different mode. So we would make fun of that, and they would go along. And so it was different for me to sometimes see all of these sort of roundabout ways to talk about something, whereas I was used to going directly to the point.
Absolutely. And I mean, you touched a little bit about the importance of American leadership to NATO. I was going to ask you, do you have any takeaways, you know, from your time as ambassador as to kind of NATO's strengths or weaknesses as it's currently constructed or even constituted?
Well, the strengths are it's the strength and the weakness, really, that everything is unanimous. And so everything we do, every point we make during a summit where you have the declaration, which becomes the Bible that you go to for everything you do, it comes from that declaration that comes out of a summit. And so the strength of NATO is that you have to agree 100% unanimous consent. And that means you have to negotiate words, you have to negotiate priorities. And so it's a strength when you get to that point that it is unanimous and everyone has come together. But The weakness is that one country can hold up everything on a parochial issue. Most countries don't do that. But every once in a while, a country will say, I'm not budging because of something that that country did to my country. And it could have been yesterday. It could have been 20 years ago. And so you have to get through that. So it's a strength and a weakness. There's no concept in this treaty to kick someone out. So we have a treaty with 32 countries that has no way to expel a member. And to come in is very arduous. You have to meet certain standards of freedom of speech, of freedom of the press, of a resilient democracy. You have to have a working military. When a country tries to enter NATO as an ally, you have to have certain standards. And so that's good. But then when a democracy starts going away from resilience or freedom of speech or the original purposes for which you got into NATO, you can't really expel a country. And I think that is a weakness. But it's where we are. And in the treaty itself, there's just no way that you can say to a country, you're no longer here. Now, you can say to a country, we cannot share this information with you. So if you buy a Russian S-400, you're not going to have certain communications capabilities within the alliance. So you can do certain things, but you can't really expel a member. And what you're trying to do is have the strength of the unity.
And on that note, I mean, do you, you know, feel confident about the state of unity within NATO right now? Or is, you know, NATO kind of well positioned to deal with some of the different global challenges, whether that's, you know, Russia or China, for example?
Well, I think that's the important question. And I think that NATO is united on China. I think that all of the steps that we've taken to make China a potential adversary as a group is important because we are unified. Unified in, I would say, varying intensity. So some countries are still going to China and saying, well, you know, Taiwan is not our problem. That's America's problem. And so we want to keep trade. But I think when push comes to shove, our best strength is going to be when NATO is united economically to challenge China being adversarial. So from China, I think it is a unity, even though it's a little tenuous in some areas. Mostly it is going to be, when the time is right, an economic leverage that we have if we are together. Now, Russia is a little more tenuous because at least two of our countries and maybe one or so others are playing both sides with Russia. You just have to say they are. And that makes it harder to deal with the Russia issue, although none of them have gone to the lengths of actually opposing something that was important to the rest of NATO. But there have been differences where a country opts out. And normally that takes away from the unity, but it hasn't been an actual adversarial situation at this point.
I mean, kind of on a similar note, in the last several months, European leaders have expressed anxiety about NATO's future, especially in reaction to remarks or decisions that have been made by the Trump administration. For instance, Germany's chancellor has inquired whether NATO will remain in its current form. What thoughts or reactions do you have to concerns like these? Are European leaders right to be distressed about America's commitment to NATO?
Well, I think that they are questioning, some are questioning, and that is true. And I think that it's important that we stay united. But I think the Europeans have begun, not just right now, but really the withdrawal from Afghanistan was the first time that the Europeans have ever just really said, we want to stay in Afghanistan, and they were there. The NATO forces in Afghanistan were 8,500. The U.S. forces were 2,500, and no one was in combat. We were advising and helping the Afghan military build up, and they were the ones fighting, and they were the ones losing their lives, but they were willing to do it. And the European allies that were there wanted to stay, and our military wanted to stay because we had kept a very tense stalemate from the Taliban taking over. So that was the first time that we did something that was so starkly against what the Europeans wanted that I think the trust in our strength was tested. And then I think this situation with Ukraine has further made that an issue for the Europeans to say, well, we really do need to do more and more autonomously. And I think the autonomous building is what I hope we can avoid. Because if we look at the big picture, if we look at what our strategic review says is our real adversary of the future, it's China. And how do we want to face China? Alone or with really 42 of the largest economies of the world united? And when I say 42, I'm talking about 32 NATO allies. But we have, if you look at our partners, our numbers are really in the 40s. For the Asia Pacific partners like Australia, Japan, New Zealand, South Korea, those form part of our NATO partnerships. And then we have partners in the Middle East as well. And even a couple in South America. So I think that the partnerships and the allies together are our big force as we're looking at the long term. So it does trouble me if Europe starts going autonomous from the U.S. and they start building their own systems rather than being interoperable with ours, buying ours, and really supporting our industrial defense base, which Europe does. 70% of the spending of Europe in defense is on American products. It's American airplanes and American artillery. So it's in all of our interests that America stay on top in the field of deterrence and our spending on defense, our intelligence gathering. And for Europe to start going on their own, where maybe we wouldn't be interoperable and we wouldn't be partners, I think would significantly affect our national security as well as all of our allies and partners.
And I mean, sort of on this topic, are you concerned about some of the president's kind of comments about acquiring Greenland on the role that you know might have in not just relations with Denmark, but in NATO more broadly?
Well, when this first came up in the first term, actually, and the president said this, and the wonderful U.S. or ambassador to NATO from Denmark called me immediately and said, could I come to your office and could we talk a little bit about this Greenland situation? I said, well, yes, I should have called you first. And so we met, and she was very diplomatic, but she said, we want to do something with America. It's hard for Denmark with our budget to do everything that Greenland needs for building its own economy. They want to be autonomous, and we want that for them. And America could be a great partner. Also, China has been trying to buy infrastructure in Greenland. And with the new focus on the high north, we know that it's very important that we keep the infrastructure in within our NATO boundaries, where it's allies that have infrastructure in Greenland. So, well, all of the high north countries. So we addressed that, and I think everything was going along in a good direction, and then it kind of went away. But now the president has gone back, and I think a strong partnership with Greenland and working with Denmark, that is Greenland is a part of Denmark. I think we could make some very good win-win situations with Greenland if we work with Greenland as well as Denmark, and try to forge a combination where we would make investments, we would work with them for the strategic good of Greenland, Denmark, NATO, and America.
On a slightly different note, and I sort of think I know what you're going to say, but given all these different dynamics and the uncertainty right now, do you think that NATO should continue to expand?
Well, I think it depends on, of course, when you say expansion, there's the expansion of the alliance and then expansion of partnerships. I think that in the alliance, you want to bring in members that seek membership. We never go out asking someone to join NATO. That's kind of a misnomer sometimes, when as if we were seeking a partner. We don't. But other countries seek us for partnerships or alliances. If they are in the European Atlantic sphere, then it would be a potential ally. But when a country comes in, they have to bring a value added. And fortunately, because of Putin's disastrous invasion of Ukraine, we got two very strong NATO partners that have been a huge value added. Sweden and Finland they have great militaries. They certainly have dealt with Russia. They are now buying American airplanes so that they are interoperable with our fighters. And so, for sure, expanding like Finland and Sweden is in our interest. And the other European countries that might want to join NATO would certainly be considered, looking at what they would bring to the table. But I do think in partnerships, we could expand. For instance, as I mentioned earlier, we have Asia-Pacific partners and we have Middle East partners. I could see us expanding in partnerships in South America that would be in our interest. Interoperability would be in our interest, having closer ties with our trade as well as security would be in our interests. And today in South America, there's a lot of Chinese activity that we could have. I think one of the great things that President Trump did was to say, we need to have control of the Panama Canal in some way, because the Chinese controlled had the major role in both ends of the Panama Canal, which with all of the other infrastructure activities that China has in South America, having more commerce with our militaries as well as our economic interests with South America would be very good. And right now, Colombia is the only actual partner with NATO. But Argentina is actually looking at it. They are interested in it. The Minister of Defense has been to NATO to see what the requirements are to have a partnership with NATO. And I think that would be good for the United States. And I hope that that increases.
So I know we're running a little low on time, but I wanted to ask one last question for you. You have a unique perspective as someone who served both as ambassador to NATO and as an elected official in Congress, who, of course, is at that point accountable to constituents back home. In recent years, we've seen diminished interest for American involvement abroad. And that's, of course, included continued support for Ukraine. In this environment, what is your view on the continued viability of strong American leadership in NATO? And what role, if any, can Congress play in strengthening American participation and engagement with NATO?
Yes, I am very secure in saying that Congress is very much pro-NATO, understand the importance of NATO. Many members of Congress travel into our military bases in Europe to see the strength that we have when we are together. And I think on a very bipartisan basis, Congress is supportive of NATO and understands the importance to all of us for this unity. NATO was formed to bring America in early after the disastrous European wars, World War I and World War II. And America is the security strength. We do assess a risk much better than any European country ever will. And then we have the strength in numbers that are so very important from our European allies. I never try to make Europe like America. They're not like America. And sometimes some of our politicians say, well, they don't do enough, and so they're useless. Well, they don't do enough. They know they don't do enough, but they are so important to help us have the strength in numbers. And when we do face a real adversary like Russia or China, we are better off when we are united. And I think Congress understands that. And I think it's better for Americans not to have to solely take the burden of our defense when we have 42 really strong economies that have collective defenses, that have interoperable assets that can fight together, that train together, that know how we can face a foe together. That's deterrence. We don't want to really go to war. We want to deter war, and we do that through strength. I mean, it's back to Ronald Reagan, peace through strength. And I think if we can stay united, I think Congress understands that, and I hope that that's where every president takes us if we're looking at the long term, and that is making sure that China doesn't encroach on our sovereignty, our way of life, our democracy, and our values.
I see we're short on time. So before I just pass things back to Caroline, I do want to give a sincere thank you to Ambassador Hutchison for sharing her time with us. We've been really grateful for your insights and perspective. So thank you very much.
Yes, Ambassador, I just want to echo Min, thanking you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, bedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at bedsoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.